This is the Breaker.News podcast for July 29th, 2018. Welcome. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, regular features like the Is It Just Me commentary, Around the Rim, headlines about the Pacific Rim, Cascadia Calling, headlines about the Pacific Northwest, The Big Deal feature, a NAFTA success story, Canada wins the American Football Junior World Championship in Mexico City before almost 33,000 fans, Bowen Island-based play-by-play man Jim Mullen talks about Mexico's role in the gridiron game, and I'll award a virtual Nanaimo bar to someone who made a difference. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or was the bombshell announcement of Trevor Linden's departure from the presidency of the Vancouver Canucks more than a tad suspicious? In 2014, when team owner Francesco Aquilini hired Linden, Linden said that he had been promised full autonomy. Quote, Trevor will be in charge of all hockey operations and make all the decisions, end quote, is what Aquilini told reporters in April 2014. The first sign of a rift came earlier this year, when GM Jim Benning was told to report to Aquilini. The club got to the first round of the playoffs in 2015, but missed postseason play in the last 3 years. But Linden's job was to rebuild the team from the ground up. He had one more year on his contract in which to show promise. The youth movement was supposed to position the team to someday do what it couldn't do in 1982, 1994, and 2011. That is, to win the Stanley Cup. Linden bled red, yellow, black, navy, burgundy, silver, green, white, and blue. All the colors of the team that he had been connected to for the better part of 3 decades. Now, for reasons that have not been explained, one of the 3 greatest Canucks of all time, the other 2 are named Sedin, is gone. What do you think? Email me at bob@thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. First, in the Mainichi, Kyoto News Service reports, preparations heating up as Tokyo 2020 2-year countdown begins. With 2 years to go until the 2020 Summer Olympics, Japan is experiencing one of its hottest summers on record, with the mercury hitting 40 degrees Celsius in central Tokyo for the first time in history. If similar temperatures strike during the July 24th to August 9th, 2020 Olympics, the health of athletes, spectators, and workers will be at risk during outdoor endurance events such as the marathon, race walking, and cycling. The International Olympic Committee has approved a plan to hold some events early in the morning to avoid the heat, and more measures may be taken to cool venues. In 1964, the last time that Tokyo held the Olympics, the event was scheduled in October. Last year's daily October average temperature was almost 17 degrees Celsius, and August was little more than 26 Celsius. Japan experienced a sweltering summer in 2010 when the heat killed more than 1,700 people, and again in 2013 when more than 1,000 people died from heat-related complications as temperatures peaked at 41 degrees Celsius. In The Independent, Jack Dominizis reports, World Rugby ready to take Rugby World Cup to United States after successful San Francisco Sevens foray. Chief Executive Brett Gosper is calling on USA Rugby to put forward a magnificent bid. The process to award the 2027 World Cup is due to begin within the next 2 years, with a decision expected around 2021. With Japan set to play hosts next year before France due 4 years later, the likelihood is that the hosts would need to be based outside of Europe. The successful Sevens World Cup at AT&T Park was the latest step towards the full Rugby World Cup being handed to the U.S. More than 100,000 fans flooded into the 42,000 capacity AT&T Park, home of the San Francisco Giants baseball team, with supporters fully engaging in the matches and proving why rugby union is on the rise across the pond. The New Zealand All Blacks were the men's and women's Sevens World Champions. In news.com.au, Frank Chung reports, "You are really getting on my tits. Sydney boss slams lazy staff in brutal Friday email." A Sydney boss has slammed his exhausting workers and warned they will feel his wrath if they don't pick up their game in a brutally honest email. Under the subject line Friday observation, the recruitment agency boss laid down the law. "Morning, guys. Quick observation that is really getting on my tits," the email said. "You are a cost. You are demanding and exhausting, and you don't even look like you are trying. One, endless ping pong during business hours, especially from people with no money on the board. Two, not even bothering to put a suit on or pretending to look the part, again, with no money on the board. Three, some of you are taking more sick days than Tom Hanks during the dying days of Philadelphia, again, with no money on the board and being a cost to the company and me personally." The boss ordered staff to, quote, "up your game or you will feel my wrath," end quote. In response to a series of questions from news.com.au, including why he keeps the ping pong table, he said in a statement, quote, "The email I sent to our Sydney office was ill-considered and thoughtless. It was sent in a moment of frustration and was an error of judgment," end quote. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In McClatchy News Service, David Goldstein reports, "Crops go unharvested and animals go uncared for. Concerns about farm worker shortage grow." It is nearly apple picking time in Washington's Yakima Valley. Cherry season will be around for a few more weeks, and a bounty of other fruits and vegetables are maturing on branches and in fields. Just one problem: a shortage of workers to bring in the harvest. It has been an issue in Washington and other farm states for several years. For Washington's iconic crops, apples, cherries, and pears, the work lasts less than 6 months. Construction jobs last longer and pay more. Many farmers have had to rely on undocumented workers. Perhaps as much as 60 to 70% of the laborers working on farms and ranches across the country might not have the proper documentation. But a crackdown on the border controls and an increase in deportations under both the Obama and Trump administrations have cut the labor pool further. Some farmers have responded by moving their operations to Mexico, where the workers are. In the Oregonian, Betsy Hammond reports, "Portland will require all landlords to register their apartments by late 2020. The Portland City Council unanimously enacted new rules to require landlords to register the addresses of all rental units in the city each year. The idea, city officials said, is to create an accurate citywide census of apartments and homes for rent and also make it easy to send communications to all renters and landlords. Landlords will submit the addresses along with their yearly city business tax filings. That will require an estimated 10,000 or more landlords who haven't been required to file business taxes because they gross less than $50,000 a year from the rentals to begin filing. The Census Bureau estimates that Portland has about 127,000 occupied rental homes and apartments. By its estimates, rental units make up nearly half of all homes inside the city limits. And in the North Shore News, Brent Richter reports, "North Van Airbnb host fined thousands for operating illegal hostel." A Central Lonsdale Airbnb host, who sometimes welcomes more than a dozen guests per night in her three-bedroom townhouse, has been ordered to pay thousands of dollars in fines to her strata and shut down her illegal hostel. But according to residents at the Beaches townhouse complex on West 13th Street, Emily Yu is still bringing in dozens of guests, and the city has been slow to react to their complaints. Yu has been advertising her Oasis Hostel, just a block away from North Vancouver City Hall, since 2016 on short-term rental websites including Airbnb, Hostel World, and Booking.com. Starting in November, strata councils in BC can fine up to $1,000 a day. Yu has not paid any of the fines and has fought unsuccessfully in court to continue her hostel, which could bring her between $70,000 and $212,000 a year in revenue. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. You could call it a NAFTA success story. Team Canada won the Junior World Championship of American Football in Mexico City before almost 33,000 fans on July 22nd. A team from the nation known better for three-down football edged a nation that is known better for soccer by a score of 13-7.
Primera oportunidad de gol en la yarda 4. Entrega la pelota. ¡Touchdown! Anotación para México. Vaya jugada y estrategia, Alan Reyes.
And he's down in the field of play. The clock will run. 2-1. That should be it. That should be game. And indeed it is. Canada back to back gold medalists. The first back to back gold medalists in IFAB history for this World Junior Championship. They did it on the road. They did it in front of a hostile crowd. And they are fully deserving of the gold medal.
Those were the sounds of the broadcast on CBCSports.ca and Canal Una Vez in Mexico. A good news headline amid so many questions about the future of football, from demographic changes in Canada and the U.S. to the impacts of brain injuries. Jim Mullen is the voice of Canadian University and Amateur Football and the host of Crown Countdown U. Mullen spoke to the Breaker.News podcast from his home in Bowen Island, B.C. about Mexico's role in the gridiron game.
I've been paying attention to university football or college football in Mexico for some time now. They've been playing it for over 90 years. And there is a rich history around the game, the four-down game, of course, where specific facilities have been built for American football that happen to be used for soccer as well. In most cases, it's a soccer stadium converted for American football. But you can see the infrastructure as you fly into Mexico City. You can see the gridiron fields as you fly in. As a matter of fact, they're more distinctive in Mexico City than they would be in a place like, say, Toronto when you fly in. The culture of American football is there. If you watch on ESPN Deporte, they don't call it Deporte down there, they just call it ESPN. You'll see that behind the avalanche of soccer information, kind of like hockey information up here, the number two sport in terms of profile would appear to be football, even though it's outside of the NFL season. There's two conferences in Mexico, about 42 schools play at the top conference level. There's a couple of secondary conferences as well. The university game is mainly concentrated around the Mexico City Capital District and Monterrey, but there are players that come from all over the place. The starting quarterback and the starting running back came from Juarez, which is right on the border. And a number of the high school teams that are in close proximity to the United States will play exhibition games against U.S. high school teams. As a matter of fact, some of the university teams are now playing Division II teams to get more competitive exposure. The culture of the game in Mexico is very much theirs. It may be American football, but when you talk to the coaching staff about influences and you know what they've pulled from around the world, it's very much incubated in Mexico. So I think it was significant that you had 32,515 in Estadio Olimpico paying $20 Canadian a head to get in. I think that that's a lot of money for some of the people that showed up to this thing. They're very loyal. They know the game inside out. It's a fantastic football market.
This is important for football to expand at a time when it needs to expand, but also find ways to play the game in a different fashion.
Well, I think one of the things that held back the development of the game internationally is that you had a spat in IFAF where there was essentially two international bodies managing two different groups of the game. You have basically the leadership group that was the United States, Canada, Japan, Mexico, the Scandinavian countries, and Australia in the traditional group. And I'd say it'd be about 4 years ago, at the time that IFAF was selecting a president, a breakaway president went and collected a number of the European countries, and then countries that had federations but didn't even have football up and going, and selected their own president. And this battle was protracted over a number of years, finally settled in the Sport Court of Appeal in Paris, I believe it was back in April. At that time, the real IFAF, shall we say, discovered that 200,000 euros had been pilfered from their bank account. They were down to 16,000 euros to operate an entire operation. The renegade IFAF was led by a guy by the name of Tommy Viking. And Tommy was responsible for putting together a European championship, and was found guilty, I believe, of pilfering money from that. And this is even before he went into this. So, you know, you could say IFAF in some ways is a mini FIFA. These international sports organizations always have a bit of intrigue to them, and I think that's really hurt the progression of the game. But finally, IFAF's back on the rails. And I think this this World Junior Tournament, some people refer to as a U19, a World Junior Tournament, with this sort of success at the gate, and you know, we chipped in. Not only did we do this game for the CBC, but we also put this out worldwide on Yar Media. So it's a beginning point, I think, for them to get their TV and broadcast packages into place for major tournaments. And I think that the big decision for football at an international level is it going to be 11-man? Is it going to be 7-on-7? Or is it going to be flag? I think that's the biggest question facing people in international gridiron right now, in terms of where do they take this thing to get to an Olympic Games. I think the first target for football as an international competition at a major games will probably be a Pan American Games.
There are teams, leagues, various sorts in Mexico, Japan, France, Britain, Australia, Brazil are also big football countries involved in the IFAF. This has to be something that for you, who is the voice of Canadian amateur and university football, must be very proud of.
Well, it's nice to see things turning the corner, and it's you know, just like the World Cup, even though this is on a much smaller scale, it was compelling to watch teams, especially in a game like football, where teamwork and different attitude and body types all come together under one roof, really express a cultural identity. You know, Mexico was all about passion. You know, Canada was all about inclusion. The Japanese had an expression. Quite frankly, the Americans were arrogant, which is why they weren't in the gold medal game. They were arrogant and sloppy, unfortunately. So the tournament itself is fantastic. I'm a little worried in terms of where they want to take this tournament. Right now, it's a U19 that happens once every 2 years. There's been talk about turning this into a U20. It happens once every 4 years. I think if you're a 17-year-old player looking at a U20 team that wants to play internationally, you could completely miss the cycle. That would be highly unfortunate. You know, I'd like to see a U20 tournament at least once every 2 years. I think once a year right now, given the economic base of a number of these organizations, would be a little too challenging. I know that I talked with my sponsor of my TV show about possibly doing a Canada versus USA game, or a Four Nations Cup, playing three down football in the off years of the World Junior Tournament. And I think, you know, there may be an opportunity for something like that. Now that there's, you know, there's Mexico and Canada realize that, at least through the football world, that they share a whole lot in common. And I think Mexico would love to take an opportunity to play Canada again in an off year.
talk about what people can expect in the year to come from Canadian college football through U Sports, as well as Crown Countdown U, the program, the media platform that you direct and guide.
Well, Crown Countdown U is a weekly TV show directed towards amateur football in Canada. We got a fairly decent rating on our TV side on CHCH last year, about 108,000 a show, which was fantastic. I quite honestly didn't expect that, but there's obviously a lot of eyes out there that want to engage through Central Canada and the 6.2 million homes. That'll start towards the end of August. Our online, for those of you who don't get CH, is on cbcsports.ca this year. So we're very, very happy about landing that and being on that platform. As for U Sports, the Western Mustangs, the defending Vanier Cup champions, lose very little this year in terms of turnover. They have to be considered one of the favorites. I think if you're looking at the three top favorites right now, it would be Western, Laval, because Laval hosts the Vanier Cup this year. After two highly or maybe sub-mediocre years in Hamilton with the game drawing not very many people, under 10,000. I think they announced 10,700 for the last game, but there wasn't that many people there. The UBC Thunderbirds, who have had a great recruiting year, who have had transfers come in. We expect a lot out of Michael O'Connor, the quarterback that went to IMG Academy, was at Penn State, and then came to UBC in 2015 and won a Vanier Cup. Calgary certainly can't be counted out of the mix as well. So I think those are the teams you're looking at. Maybe the Montreal Caravan can sneak in there and upset the Rouge Or. Those are the leaders in terms of favorites for the Vanier Cup.
That was my interview with Jim Mullen, the play-by-play voice of Canadian university and amateur football. Follow Jim Mullen on Crown Countdown U starting in August on CHCH TV in Southern Ontario and nationwide on cbcsports.ca. Search for Countdown U on Facebook. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to a deserving person or organization that has made a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Alfonso Davies, the 17-year-old Vancouver Whitecaps midfielder who was on his way to Bayern Munich, one of the world's great soccer clubs. Born in a refugee camp in Ghana and raised in Edmonton, the $22 million sale of Davies gives him a chance to play on the world's biggest stage, the UEFA Champions League. But Vancouver soccer fans will lose another player worth the price of admission. Remember Golden Boot winner Camilo Sanvezo in 2013? He went to Mexico after the club didn't give him a raise. The Whitecaps once wanted to be in the world's top 25 clubs, but they just sold a player to one of them. Good luck, Alfonso. Make Canada proud. And make the Vancouver Whitecaps organization realize that they should have paid more to keep you here, where fans want an MLS Cup trophy to go along with that 1979 Soccer Bowl trophy. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for July 29th, 2018. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on July 29th in 1923, James Charles Marshall was born in London? You may not have heard of him, but you've heard his 1962 innovation, Marshall amps. Jimi Hendrix and Jimmy Page used them, and Spinal Tap said that they could be turned up to 11. Marshall died in 2012 at age 88. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week,